Hello, this is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and welcome to Northland Views. We're reading today from the White Mountain Independent newspaper. And the first headline, from Sholo. Sholo man sentenced to 24 years for killing two people with a vehicle, based on a staff report. A Sholo man who killed two people with his vehicle was sentenced to 24 years in prison on January 8th, after pleading guilty to first-degree murder and aggravated assault. According to the Navajo County Attorney's Office, back on July 17, 2024, Bradley Eiler, now 29, of Sholo, Isaiah Hargraves, 27, of Eloy, Arizona, and a third man got into a fight. After the fight, Eiler and the third man got into Eiler's vehicle, and Eiler aimed his vehicle at Hargraves and Alyssa Marie Jagger, age 29, of Lakeside, and hit them with his vehicle. Alyssa Jaguar later died at Summit Regional Medical Center in Sholo. Isaiah Hargraves sustained a fractured pelvis and multiple abrasions and deep lacerations to his body, face, and head. Eiler will serve 24 years with the Arizona Department of Corrections without the possibility of early parole. And from Pine Top Lakeside is the headline. Judge denies request from Phoenix TV station to unseal victim statements in a body case. An article by Suzanne Adams Okrasa. On January 9th, Navajo County Superior Court Judge Joseph Clark upheld a gag order and a court order sealing from public view statements made in court by some of the victims during Michael Abadi's arraignment back on December 31st, 2025. Michael Abadi is accused of killing his wife, Carrie Ann Abadi, in November 2025 in her home in Pine Top. He is charged with first-degree murder. Matthew Kelly, an attorney for KPNX Channel 12 in Phoenix, argued in court on January 9th that the victim's statements were read in open court on December 31st, and that the media has a right to report what happens in an open court hearing because it's in the public's interest to know what's going on in an open court hearing. Kelly also argued that the order sealing the statements by Navajo County Superior Court Judge John Saline after the hearing was prior restraint and an infringement on the station's rights under the First Amendment and the Arizona Constitution. And Kelly cited numerous cases in Arizona and the federal level to support his argument. Kelly said that KPNX was not seeking to unseal the written findings of the victim statements. The statement just wanted to be able to quote or report on what the victim said in the courtroom during the December hearing on the case. Attorneys for the victims, Michael Abadi and Navajo County Prosecutor Patrick Sincola, also attended the January 9th hearing. They all agreed that the media does have a right to report on the case, but argued against lifting the seal and gag order. Owen Roth, an attorney for Michael Abadi, stated that Judge Saline had given an oral order in the courtroom before the first victim statement was read and that the statements would be under a court seal. It was only after the first victim read their statement that it appeared that Judge Saline became aware that there were media outlets on the Zoom call that was streaming the hearing, Roth said. That knowledge appeared to catch Judge Saline off guard. At the end of the hearing, Judge Saline reiterated his oral order sealing the statements, Owen Ross said, and he told reporters in the hearing to respect that order and not report on what the victims had said in court. No other portion of that hearing was sealed by Judge Saline, according to Roth. And from St. John's is the headline, El Camino restaurant closure marks the end of a longstanding St. John's institution, a story by Jen Morea. The closure of El Camino Mexican restaurant in December 2025 marked the end of a business that operated in St. John's for more than 40 years and had become a familiar presence in the community. The El Camino restaurant was founded more than four decades ago by Nestor and Juanita Montoya and remained a family-owned business throughout its entire operation. Over the years, the restaurant became closely associated with the Montoya family, with multiple generations involved in its day-to-day operations. In its later years, the restaurant was operated by their son, Michael Montoya, and his wife, Tara Montoya. During a brief interview conducted in the restaurant's final week of operation, co-owner Tara Montana said, "The decision to close the restaurant followed a series of economic challenges that began earlier in the year." According to Montoya, the business was operating normally until after January 2025, last year, when tariffs began to affect operating costs. "Those tariffs," Montoya said, "increased the price of goods and supplies, making it more difficult to manage expenses." Business organizations have said tariffs implemented this year have contributed to higher costs for items such as food products, packaging, equipment, and other supplies that restaurants and small businesses rely on. Smaller, independently owned businesses often have limited ability to absorb those increases compared with larger companies. Montoya went on to say that conditions worsened when the federal government shutdown occurred last year, which had a noticeable effect on business activity. In rural communities like St. John's and across northeastern Arizona, economic uncertainty quickly affects consumer spending. When household budgets tighten, discretionary spending, such as dining out, is often reduced, leaving small businesses particularly vulnerable. For St. John's, the loss of El Camino Mexican Restaurant represents the closing of a long-standing local business that served the community for decades. For many residents, the restaurant was a regular gathering place and a familiar part of daily life. In a message shared on the restaurant's Facebook page announcing the restaurant closure, the owner stated the decision was not necessarily permanent and noted there's a possibility the restaurant could reopen in the future. And from Sholo is the headline. Sholo woman arrested in connection with accident that killed firefighter on Lone Pine Dam Road. A staff report story. Navajo County Sheriff's deputies have arrested a Sholo woman in connection with a fatal accident on Lone Pine Dam Road that killed a firefighter in October 2025. Kayaya Williamson, age 21, of Sholo, was arrested January 7th of this year on suspicion of second-degree murder. She was involved in a two-vehicle accident back on October 3rd that took the life of Timber Mesa Fire and Medical District firefighter Glenn Collins, who was 46 years old. Williamson's truck struck the motorcycle Collins was riding around 7 that morning near milepost 7.5 on Lone Pine Dam Road in the White Mountain Lake area. During the investigation of the accident, deputies suspected that Williamson might be impaired and got a warrant to draw blood from her, according to the Navajo County Sheriff's Office. The blood was tested at the Arizona Department of Public Safety Crime Lab and allegedly confirmed the presence of impairing substances. The Sheriff's Office did not say what those substances were. The case has been submitted to the Navajo County Attorney's Office for prosecution. From the White Mountains is the headline, "Where the Land Still Works, Wolves Beyond Interstate 40," a story by Tony Gibbons. Asha, a Mexican gray wolf born wild in Arizona in 2021 to the Rocky Prairie Pack, did what wolves have always done. She followed the land. Her northward journeys into New Mexico towards places like Las Vegas and Taos ignored the lines that humans had drawn across the map, and during that time was captured twice, then confined for nearly 18 months. In August 2025, Asha was finally released back into the wild with her mate and pups. Now, another Mexican gray wolf is answering that same call. Like Asha before him, the wolf Taylor is moving north, drawn by instinct, habitat, and survival. And once again, man-made boundaries are proving no match for a wolf determined to live free. Taylor, named for Mount Taylor west of Albuquerque, New Mexico, has been captured and relocated twice by wildlife officials after establishing himself north of Interstate 40, the boundary that marks the northern edge of the Mexican gray wolf experimental population area. Each time Taylor was released far to the south in the Gila National Forest. Each time Taylor turned north again, running home. On November 22, 2025, Taylor was documented once more near Mount Taylor after being darted from the air and transported south, a cycle that conservation advocates say mirrors Ash's story almost step for step. Wolves like Taylor can't read maps, even those with lines drawn by politicians, said Michael Robinson, a senior conservation advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. He said, "They are showing us where recovery wants to happen." Ash's eventual release came only after intense public pressure and months of debate. As a result, last year, Asha was released with her captive born mate, Arcadia, and their five pups named Kachina, Aspen, Sage, Kai, and Isla, onto Ted Turner's Ladder Ranch, a 244-square-mile conservation-managed property east of the Aldo Leopold Wilderness within the Gila National Forest. Federal officials named the family the Quartz Pack, though conservation groups had previously called them the Caldera Pack, in honor of Ash's repeated journeys to the Valle Caldera National Preserve territory biologists have described as suitable wolf habitat in New Mexico. For supporters, Ash's release marked a long-delayed course correction. Ash should never have been punished with captivity for following her instincts, says Greta Anderson, deputy director of Western Watersheds Project. She said her pup now have the chance to contribute to a population that desperately needs genetic diversity. Scientists say that diversity is crucial. The Mexican gray wolf population in the United States descends from just 7 founding animals, and forced separation from other wolf populations has led to declining genetic health in recent years. At the center of both wolves' story is Interstate 40. Under federal rules adopted back in 2015, Mexican gray wolves are allowed to roam only between the U.S.-Mexican border and Interstate 40 in the north. Wolves that cross the interstate are typically captured and relocated, regardless of habitat conditions on the other side. Biologists have long identified areas north of Interstate 40, including northern Arizona, the southern Rocky Mountains of New Mexico and southern Colorado, and the Grand Canyon region, as capable of supporting Mexican gray wolves. Critics argue the boundary reflects political compromise rather than ecological reality. Supporters of the restriction says it reduces conflicts with livestock producers and rural communities, many of whom already feel the cost of wolf recovery falls disproportionately on them. Ranchers and hunting groups have raised concern about livestock losses, effects on game populations, and the challenges of managing wolves across large, mixed-use landscapes. Several Mexican gray wolves have dispersed north of Interstate 40 into northern Arizona in recent years, including a male wolf known as Anubis, who twice traveled into the Flagstaff area before being killed in January 2022. Other wolves have since been captured, collared, or relocated after crossing the interstate. For conservationists, these cases underscore the risks of rigid boundaries. For opponents, they serve as warnings about what an expanded wolf range could mean for rural livelihoods. The divide has only widened as wolf management authority increasingly shifts to states. The stories of the wolves, Asha and Taylor, are unfolding as federal wolf policy faces renewed uncertainty. The Trump administration recently announced it no longer intends to complete a nationwide recovery plan for gray wolves, a move conservation groups say undermines the Endangered Species Act and leads recovery to states with sharply different priorities. You're tuned in to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and you're listening to Northland Views. And from Snowflake Taylor is the headline, Snowflake Moving Forward on Park and Public Trail Expansion. A story by Scott Gold. Snowflake Town Manager Brian Richards discussed the progress of a new multi-use paved community path at the town council meeting on December 2nd. The path would run from the south side of Rodeo Road at State Route 77 and head west for approximately 2 miles to connect with a Cottonwood Wash path. Richard said he was seeking council approval to apply to the Arizona State Parks and Trails and felt that the town of Snowflake could get a $100,000 grant to be used for the project. This is a longtime dream of the town of Snowflake and one that is becoming a reality, a multi-use community trail that would connect Snowflake to Taylor where people can walk, jog, and ride their bicycles, Richard said. The council voted on the town proceeding with obtaining a grant for the multi-use trail, and it was approved unanimously. Richards went on to discuss Snowflake High Desert Park, which is in the conceptual planning stages and anticipated to be 441 acres in size. The total estimated cost of the park to the town would be $1.9 million after about $1.6 million in grants are included. On a breakdown of costs, $699,000 would be the town's expense real estate, which comes to $1,586 per acre. An estimated town cost of $1.2 million would be on park, bike park improvements, and trails on this property. Richard said there is already a $929,000 Arizona State Park grant in the wings for this project, and about 76 acres of the total 441 planned acres have been donated. Additional public works discussions were held regarding roadway improvements to McClaws and Rodeo Roads west of Centennial Drive and a manhole replacement project at Fourth South. Apache Underground and Excavation LLC has submitted a bid in the amount of $59,280. And from the White Mountain Apache Tribe comes a headline: Tribal police officer indicted in alleged sex abuse kidnapping. FBI seeks additional victims. A story by Jen Morea. Carter Eugene Leslie, age 42, of White River, was arrested January 7th in Canyon Day on the Fort Apache Indian Reservation, according to the United States Attorney's Office for the District of Arizona. Federal prosecutors say a grand jury returned a 15-count indictment against Carl Leslie on December 23, 2025. The charges include aggravated sexual abuse, kidnapping, kidnapping of a victim under 18, sexual abuse through fear, sexual abuse through coercion, and deprivation of rights under color of law. According to the indictment, Leslie was an active law enforcement officer with the White Mountain Apache Tribal Police Department from April 2007 through June 2024. Prosecutors allege that while on duty, Leslie sexually abused three victims on dates ranging from December 1, 2020 through September 25, 2023. The indictment further alleges that Leslie forcibly raped and kidnapped two of the three victims, including one minor. Prosecutors also allege that he twice engaged in sexual acts with a third victim by threatening her and placing her in fear. Each of the alleged victims is a member of the White Mountain Apache tribe on the Fort Apache Indian Reservation, according to the indictment. The FBI's Phoenix field office says investigators believe there may be additional victims and are urging anyone to come forward with information. Anyone with information related to this investigation, including individuals who believe they may have been victimized by former Officer Leslie, is encouraged to contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. If Leslie is convicted, the charges listed in the indictment carry maximum penalties of up to life in prison and up to a $250,000 fine, according to prosecutors. The kidnapping charge involving a victim under 18 carries a mandatory minimum sentence of 20 years. And in sports is the headline: Defense leads Pace and Pass Alcosay in boys basketball. A story by Keith Morris. Payson's defense led the way as the stampeding Longhorns beat Alcosay by a score of 67-32 in boys basketball in White River on Saturday night. Payson improved to a record of 16-3. Peyton Stewart scored 10 of his game-high 15 points in the third quarter as the visitors outscored Alcosay by a score of 27-12 after limiting the Falcons to just 7 points in each of the first two quarters to turn an 11-point advantage into a 52-26 lead. Peyton held the Falcons, who have a record of 2-9 overall, to the fewest points they've scored in the game this season, matching the 32 points they were limited to in a loss in a score of 72-32 loss at Coolidge and the same total in a 68-32 loss to Queen Creek Benjamin Franklin High School in the Sholo Cougar Classic. Manny Cias chipped in 14 points and Marco Garrique added 10 points as 8 Longhorns, who have a 6-2 ranking, scored. Cias sank 4 of Payson's 11 three-point field goals. Stewart hit 3 trays. Adrian Dosella led the Falcons with 8 points. He made Alcosay's lone 3-point basket. 8 Falcons scored, but nobody else managed more than 5 points. Alcosay was just 3-for-5 at the free-throw line, and Payson was 0-for-2. Alcosay's 3A East game at home against Blue Ridge on Friday was postponed over concerns of possible icy roads. The game will be made up at a date later to be announced. The Falcons are 1-0 in the region after beating visiting Snowflake by a score of 66-62 on Tuesday. They return to 3A East play at home against Sholo on Tuesday. Alcosay plays a rematch at Snowflake on Friday night. Payson returns to 3A Metro play by hosting Benjamin Franklin at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday and visiting Phoenix Northwest Christian at 7 on Thursday. They wrap a business week at Gilbert Christian at 4 p.m. on Saturday. Payson is the only unbeaten team in region play. Ben Franklin and Gilbert Christian are tied for second, with Queen Creek American Leadership Academy Ironwood third with a 5-3 ranking. And for the final headline today, from the Eager Greer area, rooted in the White Mountains, Wink Kreigler, ex-Diamond Ranch, and a way of life worth keeping, a story by Jen Morea. On the ex-Diamond Ranch, history isn't framed on a wall or stored behind glass. It lives in the water channels that still run where they were first cut, in the pasture rotations adjusted season after season, and in fences repaired not once but repeatedly because the work never really ends. For Sarah Marge Wink Kreigler, that continuity isn't sentimental, it's responsibility. "You don't inherit land," Kreigler said, "you inherit responsibility." That responsibility has shaped her life and her family's for well over a century. Kreigler's family came into what is now northeastern Arizona in the early 1880s, when Arizona was still a territory and the White Mountains were still forbiddingly remote. Her great-great-grandparents first settled near what is now Nutricio before moving into the Greer area, drawn by water, grass, timber, and the possibility of making a living from the land. "There wasn't any quitting for those people," Kreigler said. "You did what had to be done." Early ranching families weren't chasing an idealized Western lifestyle, Kreigler said. They were feeding military installations, nearby communities, and themselves. Ranching was not a career choice. It was survival. "Agriculture is a lifeblood," she said. "Without it, you have nothing." Over time, her family's operation grew alongside the region itself. The ranch adapted as the West changed, surviving droughts, brutal winters, floods, wildfire, and shifting land policies. Each generation left its mark, not by conquering the land, but by learning how to work with it. Kreigler explained that early settlement in the White Mountains was tied directly to agriculture and the military presence in the region. Fort Apache and other installations created demand, and ranching families supplied food not just for themselves, but for soldiers in nearby communities. "Creating the military installations created the demand," Kreigler said. "We had to figure out how to feed them." That demand, she said, shaped Arizona itself. Agriculture became the backbone of the state long before modern industry arrived, and ranching families understood their role in sustaining both people and place. Craigler grew up riding with her father, absorbing lessons that had nothing to do with textbooks and everything to do with observation. She learned early that water, grass, soil, wildlife, and livestock are not separate. They are one system, and when one piece falls, everything else follows. She didn't have words like renewable resources as a child, she said, but she lived the concept daily. You put the cattle here, then you move them there, she said. You give the land time to come back. She later came to describe land management as similar to pruning a tree. Cut too much and you kill it. Never cut at all and it becomes unhealthy. That's exactly the same thing, she said. Grass, trees, and soil, she explained, are meant to be used carefully and intentionally so they can renew. When land is either stripped or locked away entirely, it loses that balance. Renewable resources are renewable, she said, but if we don't treat them right, they can't renew. That same grounded approach shaped one of the most distinctive chapters in local history when actor John Wayne became a working presence in Round Valley. John Wayne owned the neighboring 26 Bar Ranch and took an active interest in its cattle operation. According to Craigler, the ranch was not a showpiece or a passive investment for Wayne. It functioned as a serious agricultural operation with both registered Hereford cattle and a large commercial herd. Craigler's family worked directly for Wayne's 26 Bar Ranch. She was responsible for caring for the commercial cattle, the day-to-day work of moving, feeding, and managing the herd, while Wayne maintained registered Herefords as part of the breeding program. Wayne really cared about the cattle and the land, Craigler said. It wasn't a hobby. Her father and Wayne were friends, and that relationship translated into real work. Responsibilities overlapped, cattle were moved and managed collaboratively, and Wayne stayed engaged with how the ranch operated rather than delegating from a distance. Craigler said John Wayne attended the ranch's major bull sale and took part in the Hereford operation, not as a figurehead, but as someone invested in the outcome. His name may have drawn attention, she acknowledged, but his reputation locally was built on something else entirely, the fact that he showed up and participated. Despite his fame, Wayne was treated no differently than anyone else in the area. He went for coffee, attended ranch and community events, and worked cattle without spectacle. When he was here, he was just another guy, Craigler said. He went for coffee. He showed up. People didn't fawn over him, and he appeared to value the ability to live and work without being followed or treated differently. He was John Wayne, but he wasn't any different than anybody else, Craigler said. Today, Craigler worries that the kind of ranching her family practice, adaptive, patient, and rooted in long-term thinking, is being pushed aside. Land once used for grazing is being removed from production. Regulations continue to expand. Renewable energy projects take thousands of acres at a time. Younger generations leave and fewer return. Less than 2% of the Americans feeding the rest, and people don't think about that. Well, this wraps up Northland Views. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for listening.